Welcome to the latest edition of Wax Ecstatic. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. Thank you so much for joining in once again as we go pouring through this old box, this monster box of 5,000-plus baseball cards, primarily from the 1980s, stored deep in a closet corner. It's not even my closet. It's my daughter's closet, and she's an infant, so I'm sure I'm going to lose that storage space within a few years. But it's fun to go looking through here as we go year by year, set by set. And today we've moved into 1986, the 86 Donruss set, or as I call it, the Max Headroom set. I'll explain why in a moment, but first our random pull card, number 55, the great Hubert Brooks Jr., or as we like to call him, Hubie Brooks. Pictured in a Montreal Expos uniform, not the best of times in Hubie Brooks' career, especially since he was playing in New York just a couple years before. Traded to Montreal for a key piece in the 86 Mets World Championship team. We'll talk about that, Hubie's career, a little bit about the Montreal Expos as well. And we'll pick apart the Donruss set of 1986, one of my favorites. And it's really grown on me. In fact, even while I was pulling things together for this podcast, I just don't have enough of these cards. I was looking through what few 86 Donruss cards I have. Have a few Diamond Kings cards. Have a handful, maybe like a pack's worth of cards. And I think I may actually have more 86 Leaf cards than Donruss cards. Leaf, of course, the Canadian version of Donruss. They also put out a set in the mid-1980s, very much like OPG and Topps, their partnership throughout the 70s and 80s and into the 90s. But the more I look at these, the more I want to just get more. And maybe if I find a few extra dollars in my next paycheck, perhaps I will go ahead and scour the online world of baseball card sales and pick a few up. So we'll talk about all that in just a little bit. But first, I want to talk about what you're talking about. Everyone who has chimed in to our Twitter feed at Wax and Gum Stains, thank you so much for everybody who has chimed in. We've had a week's worth of really great conversations going on here. And just like our podcast, which you can find on Audio Boom every Tuesday and Friday, I encourage you to share our Twitter handle with your friends. I ask this pretty much every podcast. One friend, think of it. You have one friend out there who collected baseball cards when you were a kid or still collects now. And I think they would be entertained by what we're doing here, not just in the podcast, but also on Twitter. So at Wax and Gum Stains, get the word out there and get everybody talking about this great hobby that we either still love today or we loved back in the day. That's a great fun part about doing this podcast. We're not only talking about a hobby that exists now, albeit it's changed a lot in the last 25, 30 years, but we can also go down that memory lane of 25, 30 years or so, however long you've been collecting, to talk about these great cards. Now, our previous podcast was about the 85 top set. We had Chris Spire as our random pull, and we devoted a little bit of time in the podcast to the art, or lack thereof, that is airbrushing of baseball cards, which you saw quite a bit with Topps in the 1970s and 80s. Ted Ziegler with a great note here. When I think airbrush, I think Paxton Minton 78, failed presidential poster. And he included the pictures of these cards. Now, I have the Mike Paxton card in my own personal collection. I'll talk about that in a moment. But the Greg Minton card, this is just an absolute abomination of all things sacred and baseball cards and artwork and anybody who has ever picked up a paintbrush in their life. I mean, you just look at it and I mean, I can only imagine what Greg Minton looked like in real life, because this this court rendering, I guess, is not very flattering. He's got his bushy 70s hairdo. He's got the thick 70s eyeglasses. And he's got this River Otter overbite plus this porn mustache and his San Francisco Giants hat. Not even fitting him. It's just kind of plopped on his head as it was painted here. It actually reminds me, and I tweeted this out in response to Ted's tweet, it reminds me of, remember a few years ago, there was an elderly woman who was paid to kind of reconstruct an ancient, like a 13th or 14th century painting of Jesus Christ, and she butchered it so much it actually looked like something out of a Mr. Bean movie. You know, you had a picture of Christ and it turned into this like brown, swooshy, fluffy, weird rendition of art from the Middle Ages. That's exactly what the Greg Minton card looks like to me. It is just, it's so bad. It's ridiculously bad. I mean, you think Andy Etchebaren's eyebrows and our Twitter avatar is bad? The Greg Minton poster is just terrible from the 78 top set. Now, looking at the Mike Paxton card, I said that I had this in my own personal collection. Not that I ever went out and shopped around for Mike Paxton cards, but I remember when I was a kid, I want to say maybe 12, 13, 14 years old, while my main point of collecting cards was through wax packs and ripping through the packs and trying to assemble sets. I remember around this time, I used to buy vending boxes. Now, they weren't the factory vending boxes from Topps or Fleer or Donruss. They were these secondhand vending boxes. And I don't think anybody does these secondhand vending boxes anymore. You see the secondhand pack sets that are going out, and you can find them at any store. Well, anyways, back in the early 90s, these vending boxes, I remember used to buy them. There was a warehouse store called Pace. It was kind of a predecessor to Sam's Club and Costco and BJ's. And Pace would sell, it was this 400 count box, but I think they only put 250 cards in there. It wasn't a very good assortment. It was basically a lot of cards from 86, 87, 88. But I remember through, of all places, Amway. Amway, in their catalog, used to have these vending boxes. And it was the same thing. It was a 400 count box, but they advertised 250 cards in there. And not only did you have some fairly recent cards, remember this is like 1990, 91, but you also had, they would put cards from the late 70s in there. And as a 13-year-old kid, finding baseball cards from the late 70s was really cool, especially in this, you know, nondescript vending box that costs like $10 for 250 cards. So I remember the first box that I got from Amway. It was either a birthday present or a Christmas present. I would always ask for this for a holiday or a birthday gift. But finding all these 78 Topps cards, and there were probably like 10 or 12 of them in there. And one of them was Mike Paxton. And I'm looking at this card and I'm thinking, what the hell is this? What did Mike Paxton sleep in on picture day? We have to, you know, it isn't just airbrushing Mike Paxton's hat. I mean, it's a complete painting. It's an oil recreation of Mike Paxton. Pretty good piece of art. I think they make him look good here, but who's sitting around the Topps offices goes, guys, we have to have a Mike Paxton card. Where's that photograph? Oh, we don't have it. All right. Go get Bob in the art department. I want him to airbrush up with Mike Paxton. No, not just his hat and jersey. I want him to completely fabricate this guy. I don't even know what Mike Paxton looks like because my only reference to him is this incredibly eye-popping artist rendition of Mike Paxton from the 1978 Topps set. So, Ted, thank you very much for sharing those. David Armour talking about 85 Topps says 85 Topps is a disaster. Oh, David clearly falling on the side of the fence there that says you don't like it. And I mentioned this in the 85 Topps podcast. I think it was one of those sets, unlike 83 and 84, where pretty much everybody likes the set. 85 Topps falls in the same boat as 81 and 82. You either like it or you don't. I like it. I know a lot of people like it, but clearly David doesn't like it. So thank you for sharing your thoughts there. I sent out a tweet a little earlier on Monday asking the question, what was your most iconic baseball card set in the 1980s? This stems from a question we got about a week ago asking me what I thought would be an iconic 80s set. And again, iconic, there's so many different definitions for that. What's iconic to me may not be iconic to you. So this is a question we'll throw out there every now and then because I'm curious what our listeners think. And if you want to comment on it, you can comment anytime at Wax and Gum Stands on Twitter. So we put out the tweet, got a few responses. We'll start off with Tony Warden, the 1980 set, just because that was the first set I completed by buying wax packs. I started collecting in 77. Great point there, Tony. And this was an example that I used when I was talking about iconic sets. For me, the 87 top set is iconic for a number of reasons, the design, the star power, but also that happened to be the first set that I was able to assemble through purchases of packs And it's really fun when you can pull together a set like that, or even better, if you can pull together a couple of sets and sell one of them. I managed to sell a couple of 87 Top sets at a garage sale or a yard sale. You know, you don't net a whole lot of money, but when you're a teenager, you can pull in 15 or 20 bucks for a set of baseball cards you assembled. That feels like you accomplished something there. So for Tony, it was 80 tops. For me, it was 87 tops. But obviously, all these years later, being able to pull together a set through the means of purchasing packs, that sticks out. You know, that's iconic for you because you spent the time and money to assemble that set and proudly show off 792 cards in a little cardboard box at some point in time. Pasquale Prezioso, I hope I have that right there, also says 87 tops. The wood-looking border made it look like it was encased in a bat. Plus, that was and is everywhere. 87 tops is still iconic to me because it's still everywhere, and it's part of that overproduced era of baseball cards from the late 80s, but it's such a good set. You can still easily assemble it. You can easily get packs, cello packs. You can easily get the filler cards to complete the set, and you can even buy the complete set, still factory sets, at a very reasonable price there. One more iconic set comment from Ben Adams, as he also mentions 87 tops because of Canseco and Maguire, but he adds the iconic 88 Donruss. That'll be a surprise for some people. When I started collecting, Diamond Kings were cool. Yeah, Diamond Kings were a very nice set, and that's something I've failed to really talk about with the Donruss sets. But the Diamond King sets were a really nice part of the base set, and you knew it was the first 26 cards of each set. But you had some really good artwork by the Perez Steel Galleries. And depending on how invested I was in any particular year's worth of Donruss cards, sometimes I was able to complete an entire set of Diamond Kings throughout a purchase of one box. You could pretty much get the whole set there. Unfortunately, Diamond Kings became a pricier subset, an insert set in, I think, 92. They started doing that. And while the cards were shinier, while they were a little more scarce, while they had more value, trying to assemble an entire Diamond King set, you know, in 88, you could buy a box for $10 or $15 and do it. Well, by 92 or 93, depending on the player that was portrayed in the picture, sometimes it was $10 or $15 a card. Now, the 88 Donruss set, we'll talk about that set in a few weeks, but I got to tell you, Ben, I loved that design. I thought it was a really cool design, and that was also right around the time that I started collecting baseball cards, so it's memorable to me. Of course, the downside is there's enough 88 Donruss cards in the world still wrapped in wax papers and in cardboard boxes to wallpaper everybody's living room in North America. And you'd still have some that weren't open. So unfortunately, the design is nice, but yeah, still way, way, way too many of them out there. But I still like them. It still need to open up a pack and kind of look at them, but a lot of the times you don't necessarily put those in the vinyl pages of your collection. One other comment from Ben Adams, as he says that he likes listening to the podcast. Thank you so much. I just got back into collecting after a long hiatus, and I'm not just adding the O's to long. That's what he actually typed into Twitter. And that's my story too, Ben. You know, very much like you, collecting in the late 80s and early 90s. The 1994 baseball strike pretty much killed it for me. Of course, the hobby blew up so much by then. It just wasn't as fun to collect cards. And then on top of that, by the early 90s, I was a teenager. I was, you know, chasing girls and trying to, you know, get a nice car and, you know, started working. So, you know, all of a sudden the hobby fell by the wayside, but been able to get back into it, especially the last, I'd say, 3 or 4 years, not only because of the cards I managed to hang on to, but I've got a six-year-old son who's really into baseball and also baseball cards and other collectibles like that. And it's just fun to go through all the cards with him. It's a neat father-son moment every now and then when we get a chance to go out, buy some cards, and go looking through them when we get back home. So thanks again to everybody who commented this week at Wax and Gum Stains on Twitter. You're always welcome to share your comments, your thoughts, questions. Also, if you want to chime in on your iconic set from the 80s and why, I'm very curious because everyone's going to have a different reason why they like each set. So again, at Wax and Gum Stains, when you get the chance, more than happy to read your comments and share them here on Wax Ecstatic. All right, let's take a look at the card that we have pulled, card number 55 of the 1986 Donruss set. Hubie Brooks, and Hubie is wearing his Montreal Expos jersey here, and I'll talk about that in the picture of Hubie here in a moment, but let's look at the card design. As 86 Donruss, as I mentioned at the start of this podcast, is a set that I've really grown to really like. I've always liked 86 Donruss, but as I'm looking through these cards and as I'm, you know, really noting the details and reading up about the specific sets, 86 Donruss just keeps growing on me. And the good thing, if you're a collector, is that 86 Donruss is still plentiful. Now, it's not like 88 Donruss, where there's 10 billion cards still out there, but 86 Donruss is still plentiful, but it's still affordable. I was actually pricing wax boxes, unopened wax boxes, anywhere from $20 to $30. And you know, to me, that's a bargain, especially when you're talking about a 30-year-old card set. If you can find a box of them for that low of a price, again, without the complete oversaturation like you see from a lot of sets in 87, 88, and 89, then it's a pretty good buy. So depending on where you buy them from, you can get them for a pretty decent price. Now, even though the card collecting market softened a lot in the last 30 years, there's still some pretty stellar cards in here, and they're all rookie cards. The big one, Jose Canseco, card number 39. It was one of the few rated rookies that Donruss got right over the years. Canseco, when he was in his prime, this was about 25 years ago, early 90s, when he was in his prime, that card, you would see it sold for $75, $100, $150. It was a lot harder to find the 86 Donruss product back then. And for especially younger people, I'd say people under 30, I don't think you realize how big of a stud Jose Canseco was during the late 80s and early 90s. This guy, you know, because of books that he's written and what he says on Twitter and reality shows that he's appeared on, I mean, this guy is now a circus sideshow. He's just an absolute dope. But back in the late 80s and early 90s, Jose Canseco was Major League Baseball. Now, that may be a bad thing in your opinion. In fact, in a lot of people's opinion, that's probably a bad thing. But this guy could just knock the snot out of a ball. He was a big reason why the A's were American League champions three consecutive seasons, 88, 89, 90. It's one reason why they just mowed right down the Giants to win the World Series in 1989. Canseco was just an absolute beast. And not only was he a beast on the field, but he was a superstar off the field. And he was making some mad money, too. I'll never forget, in the summer of 1989, he signed a contract that paid him, I think it was $3.33 million a year, something like that. Oh, the outrage. Oh, how could you pay this guy $3.33 million a year to hit a baseball? Well, you know, Jose Canseco is at least a 40-40 guy. You know, now, $3.33 million a year, that gets you the platoon shortstop and second baseman. The one guy who appears in 58 games probably hits .218, but he's got a pretty good glove, and there's some sabermetric stat that says he's worth $3 million a year. But Canseco was just incredible. And if you follow the game in the early 90s, you'll remember your reaction to his trade to the Texas Rangers. It was at the tail end of the 1992 season, where Oakland just, you know, this is where they just blew things up and started going in the money ball direction. But Jose Canseco going to the Texas Rangers of all teams. And then from there on out, you know, he was just kind of bouncing around. He was with Texas for a couple of years, and then Boston, Toronto, Tampa Bay. I mean, he played for several teams down the stretch. But back in the day, this guy was the king of baseball. I remember there were publications speculating he would be the next Babe Ruth. Well, maybe off the field, certainly not on the field. And we all know about the controversy surrounding his, let's just say, physique, as we would usher in an era of a lot of ball players where that question was tossed around there. So Canseco was the big card from that set. Other big rookie cards, Fred McGriff, Tampa native, had the pleasure of working with him on radio for a couple years a while back. Paul O'Neill, Andres Galarraga, Darren Dalton, and Cecil Fielder, some of the bigger name cards from the 86 Donruss set. And one of the reasons why the Donruss set it continues to really carry its weight 30 years later is not only the star power, especially with the rookie cards, and also the affordability and the plentifulness, despite not being completely oversaturated. It's just the design. Now, you heard me say this was the Max Headroom card in 1986. If you are, let's see, I'm 38. I'll be 39 in October. If you're roughly my age, maybe 2-3 years younger, anybody who's 35 or older, you know what Max Headroom was. Max Headroom, for those who don't know or who forgot, was a British TV character. It was supposed to be this artificial intelligence, kind of this computer-generated man, basically, a TV host. And, of course, the technology in the mid-80s was just really primitive, so you couldn't actually make an AI TV host like you can now. I mean, CGI can make anything. Well, back in the mid-80s, you couldn't. So it was an actual actor caked on with a bunch of makeup and some special effects. And in the background, there was this kind of, it was supposed to be like a 3D box effect, just these lines just kind of shifting around in the background, parallel lines. And if you don't understand what I'm saying, just go to YouTube, type in Max Headroom. You'll see what I'm talking about. But that was the shtick for Max Headroom. And that's why I call this card the Max Headroom card, because you have all these vertical blue and black lines in the background with the slightly angled photograph on top. Very, very Max Headroom-ish. In fact, I have to wonder if some designer for Donruss wasn't over in Britain in, you know, 85 when Max Headroom started, because Max Headroom didn't actually hit it big in the U.S. until 87. He had a very, very short-lived TV show because it was bad. I was young back then, but I remember it was a bad TV show. But Max Headroom was also best known for being a spokesperson for New Coke. Now, we all know New Coke is example A, B, and C of how to almost completely destroy a legendary brand with a few changes that don't need to be made. You know, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. We all know the story about Coca-Cola just totally botching things up in an attempt to win over some Pepsi drinkers. Well, even though Coca-Cola went back to their classic formula, or the original formula, it was like 3 months after New Coke came out, they still made New Coke. A lot of people don't know this. They still made it for a few years. And in fact, I remember going to the World of Coke in Atlanta in like 94 or 95. You could still sample it. I don't know where they were selling it, but they were still making it, or at least they still had a bunch in storage they had to get rid of. So they're just like, oh, let's just sell it to these stupid tourists. But New Coke was still on the shelf in America for probably 2 or 3 years after they brought back Coke Classic. So they were still trying to reach out to a younger audience. Well, Max Headroom, that was their attempt to reach out to a younger audience. You know, the older people wanted their classic Coke. So Coca-Cola still tried to move New Coke to a younger audience. So they used Max Headroom. He had a very catchy slogan called Catch the Wave. And I remember Max Headroom more for the Coke commercials than his god-awful TV show. So that's why I call it the Max Headroom card. The design on the front, very reminiscent of that character in those Coke commercials back in the 80s. But it looks really sharp. Remember I said 84 Donruss was professional. It was like their first big step up. 85 Donruss was the serious Donruss. Well, 86 Donruss, very, very sharp. Looks really good. You not only have that Max Headroom background and the angled photo here. Donruss 86 up in the corner there. That was the first time that Donruss ditched the old clunky D and year logo, you know, like D85 or whatever. So it was nice and streamlined, kind of went with the look of the card. And then at the bottom, you have the player's name at an angle, his position, and the team logo. And you know how much I love team logos. And you get plenty of them here with Hubie Brooks, as you've got the Expos logo in the lower left where all the team logos went. But then you've got it on his jersey front, on his hat front. And one quick thought about the Montreal Expos. A lot of people are just longing for the days of the Expos. I remember MLB Network put together a really nice documentary on the Expos, I think at the start of the season. But let's remember, because Major League Baseball screwed the pooch on this, that's why there's no baseball in Montreal right now. Yeah, the city could have built a brand new stadium. Yeah, the fans could have showed up. Yeah, the ownership could have been and should have been a lot better. But there was a lot of shadiness starting in 2002 with the ownership transfer between the Expos, the Marlins, and the Red Sox. And then Major League Baseball really making no effort to make it work in Montreal. They just wanted to stick a team in Washington. And that's no offense to any Nationals fans. I mean, you've got your team, and it's a very good team. But, you know, rooting for the Expos and trying to make Major League Baseball bring tears to my eyes with Expos documentaries, it's like the NHL selling Hartford Whalers gear. You were a big factor in why that team went from point A to point B. So I don't weep easily for a relocated team like the Montreal Expos. Also, I should mention that even though a lot of people, especially, you know, living here in Tampa Bay and being a Rays fan, you always hear the rumors, well, nobody's showing up at Rays games. They should just move the team to Montreal. Listen, it took 40 years to pay off Olympic Stadium. 40 years! And of those 40 years, roughly 10 of them, actually about 12 of them, the Expos weren't even playing in there. So with ballpark prices now, you know, it's going to cost you $700 million to build a ballpark. The Canadian dollar is at about 76 against the U.S. dollar, 76 cents. It's going to cost $1 billion to put a ballpark in Montreal. It's not going to happen, at least anytime soon. So all those fans who think that just some team is just going to get up and move to Montreal, I don't think it's going to happen. But we still have memories of the Expos. And Hubie Brooks is a big reason why the Expos, well, kind of why they had the fate that they did. And I'm not blaming Hubie Brooks. He was an innocent bystander. Hubie Brooks, a very talented ball player out of L.A., Compton, California, is where he went to high school, at Dominguez High School. He was a stud at Arizona State University, helped the Arizona State win the College World Series in 1977. This guy was such a good third baseman in college and in high school. He was drafted numerous times, actually drafted by the Expos in 74, drafted by the Royals in 76, the White Sox in 76, the A's and the White Sox in 77. Turning him all down, finishing up his studies at Arizona State. And then when he was all done, drafted by the Mets, first round, third overall in the 78 amateur draft. And he helped solve a longstanding problem for the Mets, and that was finding somebody who was decent at third base. The Mets had all sorts of trouble, really since their inception, of having a good, consistent third baseman. And while Hubie Brooks was a very good batter, defensively, he was, let's just say, suspect. His career fielding percentage at short or at third base, excuse me, not spectacular at 93.6%. Also at shortstop, he spent a few seasons at that position. In fact, by the time he was in Montreal, as this card indicates, he was slightly better, 95.5% fielding percentage. He actually did a lot better in the outfield, and I'll talk about that in a moment, but let me get back to his trade to Montreal from New York and how he was such an innocent bystander to really the first sign that the Expos were just never going to be able to develop, spend, invest in the type of payroll that was needed for a championship team. Expos fans know the state by heart. Mets fans know the state by heart. December 10th, 1984, Hubie Brooks, Mike Fitzgerald, Herm Winningham, Floyd Yeomans traded to the Expos for the kid, the late, the great Gary Carter. And anybody will tell you, especially with the Mets, who had been building up really since the time that they drafted Hubie Brooks, and he made his major league debut in 1980. Ever since then, they needed just one more player, one more solid player on the field, one more leader, one more emotional leader in the locker room, and that was Gary Carter. And, of course, you know what they say with trades, you got to give something to get something. So Hubie Brooks, who was the long-term solution for the Mets at third base, turned out to be a much shorter term as he spent only five seasons with them. And the Mets, of course, would do just fine. They would pick up Howard Johnson, who had started his career in Detroit. And the Mets, of course, would win the World Series in 86. Now, while the Mets were carrying around the championship trophy, Hubie was doing pretty good in Montreal. As I mentioned, he had made the shift to shortstop, was doing very well there, two-time All-Star in 1986 and 87. In fact, in 86, he had arguably his best season, certainly as a hitter, as he hit .340, also had 14 home runs, 58 RBI, very consistent hitter here. And he was a guy that could get on base and deliver consistently, not only a .340 batting average, but also a .388 on base percentage. So some pretty handsome numbers here from Hubie Brooks, even though he wasn't able to enjoy the spoils in New York. He made quite a career for himself in Montreal. Now, I mentioned he made the shift to outfield, where as a fielder, he had a much better success there. Mostly in right field, he had career outfield fielding percentage numbers of 96.6%, or 0.966 if you want to read it that way. And the interesting thing is he got the chance in the outfield when a young prospect for the Expos, a guy named Larry Walker, got injured during the offseason. So the Expos needed to find somebody to stick out in right field, so they put Hubie Brooks out there. So Hubie was there for a couple of years while Walker was able to rehab and eventually start up a pretty darn good major league career. Now, Hubie left the Expos in November of 1989, signed as a free agent with the LA Dodgers. Interesting side story here. He had a choice of several teams, but he could have gone with the Dodgers or the Atlanta Braves. Of course, we all know the success the Braves would have throughout the 1990s and early 2000s, but I wonder, if the Atlanta Braves sign Hubie Brooks, do they bother to bring in Terry Pendleton? Because we know that Pendleton was a big part of that Braves success in the early 90s. I don't know if the Braves are as good with Hubie Brooks as Terry Pendleton. They're kind of the same player. A little pop in the bat. I think, though, Pendleton was a better fielder than Brooks, but similar hitters. But an interesting what if, just going to throw it out there. Time in LA did not last that long, as he was traded by the Dodgers after the 89 season back to the Mets for Greg Hansel and Bob Ojeda. Of course, the Mets were starting their downward trend there. He played a very unhappy 1990 season in Shea Stadium. Traded in 91 to the California Angels, so kind of back in Los Angeles and Anaheim. Dave Gallagher going the other way. He was granted free agency after the 92 season, and he would wrap up his career after a couple of seasons in Kansas City. And the unfortunate note for Hubie Brooks, he was known as a guy who played 1,645 games without making one single playoff appearance. That's a category you don't like falling into. That's rather unfortunate. And, you know, you look at his career numbers, and they're not bad. You know, 1,645 games. It's a career that stretched over 15 years. He batted .269, had 149 home runs, .315 on-base percentage. And it wasn't like he was with bad teams. He was with some up-and-coming teams, a couple teams that were sliding the other way. But this was a good player who was on some average but not great teams throughout his career. And even though he was part of the trade that brought Gary Carter to New York, and he went to Montreal, and he missed out on the World Series opportunity in 86. And of course, if you want to play the what-if game, you know, he could have been with the Mets in 88. Maybe he would have made a big factor in their championship series against the Dodgers that year, the Dodgers eventually going on to win the World Series. But who knows? Even though he went to Montreal and wasn't able to partake in all that fun in New York for a few years, he's cool with it. Found an article from the New York Daily News from a few years ago. He's like, you know what? It happens. It's the business. I'm good with it. And hey, all right, he didn't win a World Series, but he played 15 years in the big leagues. Pretty darn good career. One more point about the Hubie Brooks card. If you flip it over on the back, and I love the back of this card, very similar to the 88 Donruss card, but again, without the massive oversaturation. Love the black text and the blue background here. But you look at the very bottom here, career highlights, the last sentence. Oh, I love this. Hampered by pulled hamstring in 82. Gee, thanks. That's a career highlight. I was hampered by a pulled hamstring in 82. And oh, by the way, I still hit .249 in 126 games. Thanks a lot, Donruss. Still, the back of the card looks very good. And that was a design that Donruss would use right up through 1991, just changing the colors a little bit. So there you go. The life and times of Hubie Brooks, now retired and just hanging around with family, which is something as a major league ball player you don't get a chance to do while you play. So good for him to slow things down a little bit. And love that card of his. Love the 86 Donruss card. Love the 86 Donruss set. And again, a set that I'm actually thinking about going back and reinvesting in a little bit, because now that the market softened a little bit, those Canseco cards that were selling for $100 30 years ago or 25 years ago, now you can get for, you know, ungraded, you could probably get them for just a few bucks. Graded, you know, $20-$25, depending on where you buy them. So very affordable, not saturating the market, but a really sharp card. Great photography, good selection of stars, rookies, up-and-comers, and a set that just screams 1986, like only Max Headroom could stutter and scream. So what are your thoughts about the 86 Donruss set? Let me know at Wax and Gum Stains on Twitter, or anything that's on your mind. Again, Wax and Gum Stains is the place to do it. We'll share random comments in our upcoming podcast, which will be on its way Friday, as we will take a look at the 86 Fleer set, as it is business as usual for Fleer. Another sharp, attractive set in 1986. We'll do another random poll, talk about the player there. And we'll take care of all that again on Friday on the next edition of Wax Ecstatic. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. Tell a friend about this podcast, about our Twitter feed at Wax and Gum Stains, and join us for the next show.